The Tom Woods Show, episode 1974.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm really, really delighted to have Jay Bhattacharya back on the program. He is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. He has been a voice of reason in a sea of monomaniacal COVID hysteria for over a year and a half now. It's unbelievable that we're even speaking like this, that over a year and a half later, it's still craziness. But he has been an incredible voice of reason. And of course, he is one of the drafters of the heroic Great Barrington Declaration, along with Sunitra Gupta and Martin Kulldorff. And that thrust him into the media spotlight in ways I'm sure he didn't anticipate and had never experienced before. And here he is, a mild-mannered academic, and now all of a sudden, fashionable opinion is coming down hard on him, even though all he's doing is just repeating what standard pandemic preparation principles are and what standard public health measures are. So it's been quite a roller coaster for him, but I'm really, really glad that he's able to be here once again and answer more of our questions. So Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So great to have you back, and I've got a bunch of questions on my mind that I think are on the minds of a lot of people. A lot of times I have guests on, not always, but a lot of time I have them on and I ask them a question. I kind of already know the answer, but I want their spin on the answer and I want their unique take on it. In this case, I have several questions that I genuinely do not have the answers to, and I'd like to run them by you. It seems to me, first of all, let me say, when I was ill, I was very grateful that without any prompting from me, you spontaneously wrote to me with good wishes and you offered to answer my questions, of which I had several. And you were of really good cheer and very helpful to me throughout that whole ordeal. So I'm thankful to you for that.
Well, I'm so glad you got better, Tom.
Yeah, me too. Now I'm back to producing a zillion podcast episodes a week, just as before, as if nothing ever happened. Anyway, so there are a few things in particular on my mind, but it does seem as if every time I talk to you, things get worse. But just as we were about to record, you were saying that you were slightly optimistic. And man, I am desperate for some optimism. Can you make the case?
Think about where we were last year this time. We were going into the fall wave. The consensus was that that the only solution was more lockdown. And that in fact, there was no scientific dispute about that fact. And that we didn't have a vaccine that could protect against severe disease. There were essentially unbounded demands for closing schools with almost no pushback, you know, except in a few places. Well, certainly not in California, no pushback. What we have now is completely different circumstances, right? So I think people have become jaded with lockdown. People understand that the lockdowns did not achieve the purpose that they were supposed to achieve last year, and it came at great harm. The idea that there's a scientific consensus around lockdowns has been utterly shattered, in part by the Great Barrington Declaration, but also by so many scientists starting to speak up about them, the harms of them and the ineffectiveness of them. The vaccine has blunted the worst parts of this epidemic by protecting many, many, many older people from severe disease. And of course, school closures, now we have an enormous amount of a community of people who have pushed back even in blue states against the school closures that happened almost all last year, mostly in blue states, mostly for public schools. But I think in that sense, we're in a much better place. There's still, I think, still quite a bit of fear and quite a bit of sort of nervousness around what comes next. That's similar to last year. But objectively, I think we're better off.
All right. Let me push back a little bit in a friendly way. This is an honorable disagreement. but look, at this point, though, I've not been vaccinated. I had the virus. I know what the Israel study says. I see no reason to be vaccinated at this point. I have, seems to me, perfectly robust protection, so no need for that. And a lot of European countries agree with me that if I go to their countries, the various restrictions all make allowance for recovery from a natural infection. Overwhelmingly, it's in the U.S. that we don't see that so much. So now, all of a sudden, unlike last year, I might not be able to fly in a couple of months, for all I know, given what they're talking about. There are parts of the country where I can't do ordinary things. Like, I love New York City. I can't go to a show anymore. I can't go to a restaurant. I mean, you know all the sorts of things I can't do. And this has been happening now. I just heard that in Slovenia, basically, you can go grocery shopping, but that's it if you're unvaccinated. Lithuania, the same. So some countries extremely severe, and it seems to be creeping in the U.S., and Biden maybe has more things up his sleeve, and Fauci's pushing him toward more extremism. Why isn't that reason for pessimism?
So let's talk about the science about this, because I think the science of this, I think, will lead to a reversal of this within, I hope, within a short order. The findings about the vaccine are that the vaccine does not stop infection and very likely does not stop disease spread after only a few short months after the vaccine. It does have very long-lasting protection against severe disease. What that means is that the vaccination question is a private matter, not a public matter. My vaccine, after very few short months, no longer protects you. It just protects me.
Now, Ron DeSantis said that, by the way, and they jumped all over him, but he said that exact thing.
He's right.
But it's not a public health measure, really. It's an individual health measure.
Correct. He's absolutely 100% right about that. With the proviso that I think maybe like 2 or 3 months after you get the vaccine, it does reduce infections, but
okay.
So it's short-lived. So that's one. It's a private matter, not a public matter. Second, as you say, you have very, very robust protection against a severe disease and probably even infection for quite a long time after you get and recover from COVID. You put those two together, the vaccinated actually may pose more of a disease spread risk than the unvaccinated who have recovered from COVID.
Yeah. Now, by the way, let me jump in and say something here. This is the kind of thing we couldn't say on YouTube, even though it's completely correct, maybe because it's completely correct. So for this episode, I'm doing something I've never done before. For all my episodes, which most people listen to through Apple Podcasts or whatever podcasting app there is, they just listen to the audio. I put an audio-only YouTube up with just a still shot of the show logo for people who want to listen on YouTube. But for this one, I'm going to have only a placeholder video, and it'll be me saying, hey, everybody, this is a really important episode, which is why I can't afford to put it on YouTube. So here's the link to go watch it on Odyssey, Odysee. That's what I'm going to be doing from now on, because I now have one strike, and that was because I had Congressman Massey on my show. And the only medical thing we said was that you appear to have more robust protection after natural infection than after vaccination, which is, I wouldn't say entirely undisputed, but it's getting there at this point. And that was removed from medical misinformation.
Okay. So, I mean, I think the scientific evidence on this is this point overwhelming, right? So if you want to point to studies, there's a study out of Qatar that, you know, they have a pretty good health information system. They tracked all of the people that had been vaccinated over time. And what they found was that there was reinfection among the vaccinated. After 5 months, there was no relative protection being vaccinated versus being unvaccinated in terms of infection, but like 90%+ protection against severe disease for the vaccinated at 6 months. So, and then of course, there's the fact that highly vaccinated countries like Israel, Iceland, the UK, the US have seen surges of cases despite the high levels of vaccination. You just can't have that happen unless the vaccine doesn't stop infection.
Okay, so I interrupted you because I couldn't help myself, and I'll try not to do that, but I interrupted your case for optimism. So if you have further things you'd like to say, I really am all ears.
Oh, no, so I just wanted to address the vaccine mandate, because you're right, Tom, that is a cause for pessimism or unhappiness. But I think the thing is, the scientific case on this is strong enough, and they have very strong implications for the rationality of the vaccine mandates. I don't think people are going to be able to defend them scientifically. The vaccine doesn't protect you, it just protects me. So why have a mandate for it? If you've had the disease and recovered, you have very stronger immunity than if you just had the vaccine, right? So those two facts, I think, kill vaccine mandates from a rational point of view. And now it's just a dead zombie policy walking with a huge number of people unhappy about it, losing their jobs and putting all kinds of their livelihoods at risk, their ability to function in society. There's, I think, a widespread movement arising in opposition to this, and it'll be overwhelming.
One political problem here is that because of the Afghanistan fiasco, Biden just cannot be perceived as more of a weakling than he looks like now. And so if he backs down on this, it's now more difficult for him to come up with, even if he were so inclined, some kind of more moderate position. It's interesting to hear Dr. Fauci saying that Biden's position is the moderate position, because the correct position is just tell them to vaccinate. Don't give them the weekly testing option. Let me jump in on a couple of things you said, though. Rationality is going to be the word that is going to ring bells for people, because they're going to say, if I were to look back over the past 18 months at what we've lived through, the word rationality would not be the first one that came to mind, you know? So it does seem rather a thin reed to rely on after what we've seen. I mean, there was a survey done. Now, I'll grant you it was a small sample size, but I don't know, remember if it was in The Atlantic or The Washington Post or The New York Times, major newspaper. I wrote about it in my newsletter, where they interviewed some epidemiologists and they asked them, which of the following things would you feel comfortable doing? And these people, I don't know if epidemiology, with the exception of some of our mutual friends, just naturally attracts hypochondriacs or oddballs or something. But the sorts of things they were unwilling to do was just a long, long laundry list of things. And even as late as the summer of 2020, one third of them were afraid to check the mail because maybe the mail is going to give them COVID. And even as of June of this year, 17% of them were still afraid to check the mail. That's not rationality. So I fear that. And then secondly, the argument that we have to also address that they make is, okay, maybe the vaccine doesn't stop the spread, but the unvaccinated wind up being hospitalized so much more often, they're filling up beds that should go to me. And so we have to penalize them in some way or deny them care or just, you know, put them on the outskirts of society in order to maintain hospital capacity for everybody else.
Okay, let me address the rationality point first. I think that last year, I participated as an expert witness, pro bono expert witness, in a very large number of cases to try to get various aspects of the lockdowns eased when it made absolutely no sense, including like civil liberties issues. And what I saw was judges that were scared to rule. They knew they didn't want to say that, for instance, the First Amendment still applied in the U.S. and basically ruled against religious, like there was this case I was involved with where there was a Bible study. People wanted to hold a Bible study at home. And the public health person said no. And the judge in the lower courts basically said, okay, yeah, you're allowed to stop private Bible study at home in plain violation of the First Amendment. The judges have started to wake up, Tom. What I've seen is this year, there's been a lot more pushback and checks and balances. Biden is not a dictator, thank God. And there's still checks and balances left. And on the vaccine mandate, I think the judges, I mean, I don't think it'll be universal, but I think there's going to be a lot more success in fighting it in courts than we might have had last year when the judges were still so scared, both not scared just of the virus, but also scared to be seen to be not following the science, right? You know, obviously they ignored the science to follow the science, but that's another matter.
Right.
So I think I'm actually fairly optimistic. I think there's a wide enough spread movement. And it also cuts in ways that are politically interesting.
Yes. Like,
who's unvaccinated? It's actually poorer people. It's minorities that are unvaccinated. You are excluding the poor and the minorities and minority populations preferentially from participation in American life. I just don't see how that's politically viable. And I don't see how the courts are going to be okay with it. And I think it's going to be a tough lift for Biden to get his way on this.
The thing is that the opposition is so scattered and without leadership. And I know my libertarian audience will say, we don't need leaders. But, you know, I think it would be a lot better if we had some high-profile people saying, look, we're going to do this and then we're going to do that. Because sometimes we're duplicating effort or we're leaving things undone. And it's hard to know when OSHA is going to be doing the enforcing. It's hard to know how a state government can stop that. Maybe they can use the power of the IRS to just grab the $14,000 out of the business's account for every violation. It's hard to know. On the other hand, I have a comedian friend, Dave Smith, who says, I have a funny feeling next year we're going to see a record number of companies with 99 employees. So, you know, that could also happen. But what about the filling up the hospitals claim, though?
Well, hold on. Let me address the claim about the leadership, and then we'll talk about hospitals.
Sure.
So almost immediately after Biden did his speech, 28 or 30 governors around the country said, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to enforce this. Essentially, they believe that the edict is unconstitutional on its face.
And that's great, by the way. I love hearing speeches like that. But when the OSHA inspector comes to the building, what are they going to do, arrest him?
I think that's where the lawsuits are going to have to come in. And they're coming in. I've already gotten several lawyers reach out to me to help with cases around that. I think it's going to have to be the courts that push back. I don't know that you need a political leader per se, but I think political leaders can give a face to this movement. And there's a lot of people, as I said, I think I'm deeply unhappy with the sort of social implications of this. And it doesn't have any actual science behind it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll address the hospitals. So I think those two things together will kill it. Let me talk about the hospitals. So last year, a very similar claim was made about hospitals are going to get overwhelmed with COVID. And for large parts of the country, for large parts of the year, the hospitals went empty. We passed a law, the CARES Act, which gave billions of dollars of transfers to hospitals because they were going to go bankrupt because they weren't treating anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, hospitals are designed, our hospitals are systems are designed as systems, right? So you may have stress on one hospital, but that doesn't mean the system as a whole is stressed. That's why you have transfers between hospitals to sort of address that. I don't think that an unvaccinated person who gets sick is taking away a bed in the sense that sometimes pertains in places that actually do have much less hospital capacity than we have. And let me just go a little bit further on this. I think it's, from a medical ethics point of view, deeply irresponsible. Like, we in medicine have a responsibility to care for everybody. Whatever you did right or wrong in your life, you don't ask that in medicine. You just provide care as best you can, as compassionately as you can, right? And so I think it's one of these things where, like, people have lost their way if they think that blaming the unvaccinated for people not getting cancer screening last year, for instance, it had nothing to do with unvaccinated. It just had to do with panic. So people didn't get cancer screening last year because they closed. They were too scared to go to the hospital because they thought might get COVID there or something. Or hospitals were telling people not to come. I think COVID is a serious condition, especially for the older population. Hospital systems and healthcare systems are designed to manage and provide care in settings like this. If the problem is capacity, build more capacity. It's interesting, Tom. Another thing about the vaccine mandates, a lot of the effect of the mandates has been to cut as many, many nurses have decided not to get the vaccine and they're quitting their jobs or being fired from their jobs rather than get the vaccine, right? That reduces staffing. That the vaccine mandate actually makes the hospital problem worse.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting to see because, of course, we've heard anecdotal evidence about individual hospitals so far where, let's say 11 people have said that they're just going to resign or allow themselves to be fired or whatever. So that indeed is a problem. Let me backtrack a minute, though. When I said leadership, I didn't necessarily mean politics. I was thinking more in the cultural realm or in the social life that I see, for example, in Switzerland. I saw a video purporting to show people sitting in the street picnicking in front of restaurants that won't let them in. And that this sort of thing has been going on in various countries around the world, also in France. And
yeah,
we don't have that going on here, but I love that. That's so great. In your face. Here's all the business you're losing by pusillanimously going along with all this instead of protesting it like us. I'd like to see Americans do that, but there's no one calling for it.
I think the cultural movement in the U.S. of the protesting of this has been lackluster compared to Europe. But I don't know, like the vaccine mandates cut across so many people that will be harmed in their normal lives by it. And I think like last year, for instance, the ethical valence was if you're young and you violate the orders, you're putting grandma at risk, right? Well, what young person wants to do that?
Yeah.
Here you have a mandate that says you can't, if you're a minority and you're unvaccinated, you can't go to a bar or a restaurant in the city where you live. I mean,
but don't you think that'll just make them get vaccinated and then the problem just disappears?
Not all of them. Many of them will just say, what for? Many of them had the disease. They were essential workers last year, Tom. They already had the disease they recovered from.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't help them.
Right.
It's just coercion. I think the movement against the vaccine mandates is going to be fairly broad-based. And actually, let me just say it's lamentable, actually, in one sense. Because, before COVID, the anti-vax movement was a relatively fringe part of American society. The MMR vaccine, most babies got it. The DPT vaccine, most babies got it because people mostly trusted the public health. I mean, of course, with exceptions. What's happened with the mandate is it's turned a very large number of people into people who are skeptical about basic public health measures like MMR or DPT vaccines. It's greatly expanded the vaccine skepticism and skepticism about public health. And I don't know. I mean, I think on the one hand, we really, from a civil rights point of view, I think it is absolutely wrong what we're doing with these vaccine mandates. But I do think we're going to need to, at least I want to work to repair some of the trust in public health in coming years. It'll be hard because what public health has done is worked very hard to discredit itself in the minds of so many.
Let me get to there are two questions in particular that I genuinely don't have answers to that I'd like to get your insight on. And it could be that nobody has the answers to these questions. But let's talk about the southern spike. It hit not just Florida, but Louisiana and a number of other places that does seem to be coming down now. But given how much effort Ron DeSantis put in to vaccinating older people, and he had a slogan, seniors first.
Yeah.
This is a surprise, or at least to a layman like me, it's a surprise. And I'm happy to admit when I don't understand something. I think there's been way too little humility in all this, that we have an answer for every time there's a big crowd, it's a super spreader. It's all at a very low IQ level. I will admit that I don't understand why that should still have been possible given that huge vaccination effort. That's my first thing. But the other part of this is, you would think if this hadn't all been politicized, you would think the experts would look at this and say, I wonder what's happening here. This is not what we would have expected a year ago. If somebody had said, we have a vaccine and now we're going to administer it to a lot of the vulnerable people, this isn't the result we would have expected. So let's step back and try and figure out what's going on. Instead, it was Florida's getting what it deserves and blah, blah, blah. Florida opened, what, a year ago. So you're telling me that its policy from a year ago is just bearing fruit now? Come on. You know, so it's obviously not that. What is going on? So I guess my question to you is, how do we account for this? This shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, those are both really good questions and observations. So I think, like you confessed, you didn't know, and I'll confess also something. I think in January, when I thought the vaccine stopped disease spread, that's what essentially what was found in the trials. Now, it turns out in retrospect, the trials didn't follow along long enough to really demonstrate that it would stop infections altogether. If they had gone on just a little longer, it would have found that the infection blocking properties of the vaccines didn't last for a very long time. Whereas the vaccine protecting against severe disease, that seems to last quite a long time. So in January, if you'd asked me, I would have said, yeah, it's likely that this will blunt the spread of cases. Now, this disease is very obviously a regional and seasonal thing. It's not a coincidence that the South rose in cases together, and now the North is rising in cases together. You know, parts of the North, that it's a regional disease, a regional seasonal disease. In a way, the fact that Florida vaccinated its elderly population and had so much success in vaccinating quickly, in some ways led to it being less protected against infection spread than places that were slow in vaccinating. And so because Florida vaccinated quickly, its elder population quickly, it had many, many fewer deaths than other places in the winter wave. And more spread of cases, I think, in this most recent wave. So I think, you know, this is one of these things we didn't know. We didn't know the vaccine didn't stop disease spread. And that's essentially, I think, partly what happened, and partly it's seasonal. Okay, so there's that. And why the deaths? Like in Florida, if you do the math on this, it turns out that while they vaccinated a very large fraction of the older population, there were still parts of the older population still not vaccinated. And a lot of the deaths were in that group, the older population still not vaccinated, which just actually calls to like the priority for me is let's get older people the vaccine and address whatever hesitancy they have in a way by treating them like adults, giving them data and just, you know, providing them the availability of the vaccine in a way that respects them as people rather than coercing them. I think that's really that should be the priority for public health. That's the lesson from Florida's summer wave, I think.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. A lot of people have been putting crypto into their IRAs. And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, adding Bitcoin to your retirement account, the best way is through BitTrust IRA. The crypto world can be confusing. It's hard to know where to get started. These guys will help you. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And by the way, when they say nuclear bunkers, that isn't just hyperbole where they're saying it's really, really secure. We're actually talking about decommissioned nuclear bunkers. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So how do you get started? Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. bittrustira.com/woods. Do you think that, you know, I hate to make you predict things because this is, I still think it's going to be a long time before we fully understand exactly what happened here, but do you think the Northeast is going to see something comparable to what Florida saw when winter comes?
I think it's likely.
Yeah.
I think it's likely.
And then now, of course, there's no way to predict what the political classes will do up there. But I think this time around, it's at least plausible that there'll be division among the blue state governors. I mean, it was unanimity last year. But yeah. I think some of them are not so sure that lockdown is the best. They'll say, because I think they don't want to crush their economy. So I think they'll say vaccination is our way out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think, okay, so like, actually this gets back to your second question you asked me just now. Why are the expert classes not reevaluating? I think much of the expert class was in the same position as me in expecting the vaccine to stop disease spread. And they overpromised. Like, so when I wrote a Wall Street Journal piece in December of last year, basically saying the vaccine should be used for focused protection of the vulnerable. Use it to protect the vulnerable. And it turns out that actually is the right use of it. But the expert classes, what they said was the vaccine is going to stop the disease. It's going to essentially turn it to COVID zero, very close. And that's clearly not true. And so now what they're doing is rather than trying to reevaluate their premises and trying to, they're still like they're flailing around trying to find some way to cover up the missed promise or to like make good on it anyway. So, you know, like this push for boosters when there's no randomized data available about them is amazing to me. But that's the kind of thing you do when you have a failed policy and you want to like patch it up, or the push to like force vaccinate large numbers of young children. I mean, they're flailing around trying to find some reason why they might still have been right. It's like a general knows that he's lost the war, but he sends the last brigade up anyways to get slaughtered in the hope that maybe this one last sacrifice will do it.
Is it too early to have any opinion about Novavax?
I haven't seen, I mean, there's still, I don't know why it's taking so long to do the evaluation. I mean, it looked very promising, the initial data. I don't have I want to wait for the FDA to weigh in on it.
Okay. Then the other key question I had was, given, okay, vaccination levels are not as high as the U.S. government would like them to be, but they're not nothing. And when you add in the number of people who have had COVID and recovered, if we're not at herd immunity yet, and we're still getting massive waves, and we're predicting there'll be another one in New England. What would it take?
Tom, the thing is, if the vaccine doesn't stop disease spread, it's not contributing to herd immunity. I mean, you essentially should not count the vaccinated but never got the disease as part of the equation for herd immunity. I mean, there's some complications in that, but it's the first order. And what does herd immunity mean anyways? Herd immunity doesn't mean the disease is gone. It just means that at this point, one person getting infected infects one additional person or fewer. I mean,
So this is what the epidemiologist in Iceland with the unpronounceable name, but thankfully for me in Iceland, they simply call him in the press, the epidemiologist. That's how he's, it's weird. It's like there's one in the country and they just do what he says. But he recently said something very much along those lines, even though it was translated into English, but I don't think much was lost in the translation. He was saying that with these vaccines, we're not, after Iceland recently saw a big jump in cases, after they felt like they had done everything right, he came out and said, well, it looks like we can't reach herd immunity with these vaccines, but what we can do is try and shelter the vulnerable and basically just let the virus pass through society the best we can and try and manage it the best we can. That was what he said.
Yeah, he adopted the GBD. The Great
Yeah, he did. Program. Yeah, a year and a half too late, but he did it.
I mean, I think every country is going to start to realize that at some point. And the countries that have done the worst are the ones that take the longest to realize that.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, the vaccines are, Tom, I just want to like make sure the audience knows, I think the vaccines are a wonderful achievement. And they have protected so many people against the severe outcomes of the disease. I very strongly recommend people get the vaccine, especially if you're older and vulnerable. It's better, Tom, to have the vaccine first and then get the disease than the other way around. But let's be clear. I don't think it's possible to protect yourself against getting this disease in the long run. You can delay it at great cost to yourself by hiding, but you cannot, in the long run, guarantee that you will not get this disease. And I think everyone on the face of the earth will eventually get this disease.
Wow. Okay. So if there's no way to prevent it, then the question kind of becomes, what kind of life do you want to live then?
Yeah. How do you minimize the harm, both from the disease itself and from the collateral damage from hiding, you know, locking yourself away or your kids away or whatnot? That's the real question at hand, right? It's the same impetus that led us to the Great Barrington Declaration. You have to look at life as more than just infection control. And if you live your life focused on simply infection control, you're going to impose great costs on yourself and others that don't need to be imposed or shouldn't be imposed if you're wise. Further, with the vaccine, the disease itself is defanged. It's not that you won't get it, but if you're older, it's no longer a 5% or 6% infection fatality rate. It's much lower, right? Because the vaccine protects against severe disease. I actually had COVID, Tom. I don't know if I told you.
No.
Like, yeah, I got it last August. I had had the vaccine in April, you know, after my 80-year-old mom got it finally in March because the California rollout was so delayed. And then I'm like, okay, it's fine now. I can get it. Yeah, I didn't feel bad about getting it. And then in August, what, 4 or 5 months after I got the vaccine, I got COVID. And it was like 3 days of fever. I was pretty miserable and a week of fatigue. I lost my sense of smell. I was super excited when that came back, by the way. I could smell cinnamon again. I don't know why that made me so happy. But yeah, I mean, I think that kind of experience that I would recommend to people, get the vaccine. And then when you get it, it'll be blunted. Because what if I hadn't? Maybe it would have been worse. At least that's what the scientific evidence seems to be suggesting. But no, I'm just saying, given the data I'd seen, I wasn't surprised I got it. The vaccine I knew wasn't protecting me anymore against infection.
Yeah. And so I think at this point, the average person has figured this out because, number one, the CDC director herself said that one thing that the vaccine can no longer do, that was how she phrased it, is to stop transmission. And then everybody has heard of cases where people were vaccinated and they wound up getting the disease. So I think they just maybe haven't drawn the conclusion that this is pointing them to. And your point that the vaccines do not contribute to herd immunity, what they're doing, you know, you're arguing they may do something that's quite valuable, but they're not doing that. Even that is a shock to people. And yet it is the natural conclusion from all this. We just have to push people to see it. And again, I'm talking, I know some of my listeners have their head in their hands thinking, this has gone way beyond a matter of you have some arguments and some people of good faith will listen to them. There are some people who just invested in this at this point. How is Australia going to walk this back after they have completely screwed up children for a year and a half, keeping them in their houses and saying, oh, this was the wrong strategy. We just have to come out and deal with it. There's just no way. They're just going to stay a prison.
Their goal is to get to 80% vaccination and then they say you're going to open up. And then the cases will spread. It'll be super interesting to see what they do at that point.
Yeah.
I think Australia is just a fantastic case of failed promises. And then how politicians and political leaders and I guess scientists also cope when their promises have failed over and over again. I am sympathetic with your listeners, but I would just say, Tom, what option do I have? I mean, I have...
No, I know you have to preach reason. That's what you and I do.
Yeah, I have no other choice. I mean, like, right. If that doesn't work, then
yeah. We're out of it. Right. No, exactly right. Exactly right. Ian Miller on Twitter will occasionally produce graphs, and it'll either be cases or hospitalizations or deaths. And it'll show a country where the line was flat like zero for a long time. And then he'll pinpoint exactly where the New York Times or some big publication wrote an article called How Such and Such Country Defeated the Coronavirus. And then you'll see a couple of months later, it goes wildly up. And then there's no article. They don't revisit that and say, oh, maybe we were looking at this too simplistically. So same thing.
Tom, I think I took your quiz where you took some of his graphs and said, which country imposed lockdowns, which country didn't. I mean, I failed,
right.
By the way.
Right. No, it's intended for you to fail. That's right. I'm so happy that he went to the trouble of that so I could do that. But I think Australia may be coming next, as everyone's been pointing to New Zealand and Australia. Everybody. This goes to show if you're really serious, you can keep them. And so I think he could actually do a graph like that. I mean, we don't know where the numbers will ultimately go in Australia.
Have an advantage, right? So they can vaccinate their old population before the cases have spread widely. So they will have many fewer deaths, which is a great thing for Australia. I'm really pleased that Australia can do that. But it's actually, there's an irony in this. They're using a vaccine that could not have been tested or developed in their own country to protect their country. right? In order to test the vaccine, you need a place with lots of cases. Otherwise, you can't.
Oh, good point.
You can't test the vaccine. And essentially, it's like a beggar thy neighbor epidemiological policy that they followed.
That's an interesting point that I hadn't thought of. Well, let me, as we're, you know, I think we've gotten to a point where I don't want to keep you any longer. So I'm not going to, I think I'm going to skip over something that I wanted to bring up, but that is not central to what I needed to discuss with you, which mainly was the Southern spike question and herd immunity. And as I say, it would have been great to have an interesting scientific back and forth about what's going on in Florida and this and that. But really, it was just nothing but Death Santis. And we had Stephen King, the novelist, saying that, did you see there were 1,200 deaths in Florida yesterday alone? I think they might have been 1,200 deaths in all of the United States.
It's very clear that Governor DeSantis is probably the most creative political leader in the United States. I mean, I have been very, very impressed by him. And I think people are, in the Democratic Party view him as a threat. And so that's why they've had this nonsense. I wish that would just stop. I mean, like, I think this is a disease that really, the fact that it has become politicized has caused enormous problems. And the media continually politicizing. I'll give you an example. Governor DeSantis puts out this program to get early treatment with monoclonal antibodies, a treatment that's been vetted, approved by the FDA, has very strong trial evidence that if you get it early enough in the first 5 days of symptoms, it will cut your death rate by 40, 50, 60, 70%. It's a godsend, right? Everybody that has COVID, especially older people have COVID or overweight people have COVID or have some chronic illnesses or something that predispose to severe outcomes, should be getting it. Every single one. We've spent trillions of dollars, Tom. Why should not everybody be getting this? So he rolls out a program to do it. And there's like strange political pushback to it, a treatment that actually works.
Yeah.
And everybody agrees it works.
Yeah. And then about a month later, I saw Dr. Fauci make a presentation with slides walking through explaining monoclonal antibodies, explaining their effectiveness, saying that they are dramatically underutilized at the moment. And that everyone should be aware, particularly physicians, of this very, very effective treatment. That was what he said. So even Fauci comes out and says that. I don't know if that shut them up or what, but that was bizarre, that response. So it's just, as long as it has DeSantis's name on it, they're just going to be against it? That's scientific.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really weird to me. I mean, I guess I don't pay attention to politics. I mean, I should have paid more attention to politics, but it's just odd. Like, this is a treatment for a disease that everyone agrees is bad for people that are older, especially. And you have a governor that's trying to make it as easy as possible to get this as quickly as possible so that you can save lives. And somehow that's bad. I can't understand it.
Well, it's nothing but politics then at this point. But the idea that you would take a governor who had a state, you know, with a lot of potentially vulnerable people in it, and a very politically divided state. I mean, he won by not very many votes at all and somehow managed to generate a very good result. If you look at Florida in terms of age-adjusted mortality, it's one of the best. And certainly among the big states, it's definitely one of the best. That's an amazing achievement. I don't care what party he's from. You should be congratulating him for it. And for them to be calling him Death Santis, it's like you...
No, it's disgusting. It's just
it's insane.
Tom, someone put... Yeah, I've been an advisor, informal advisor to DeSantis, and someone put posters of, so Governor DeSantis tweeted a picture of me giving testimony where I said, look, but by vaccinating the older population, we are protecting the vulnerable. That's literally the quote. And I stand by that, by vaccinating the older population.
Who could be against that? That was the thing I thought I would skip because I didn't want to keep you too long. What's been going on your campus with the posters and attacking you?
Someone put the posters of this up and put a graph of Florida death rates. You know, California has higher age-adjusted COVID mortality than Florida does. And what, we follow the science and Florida doesn't, and they have better results? The science, trademark. I mean, yeah. I just can't, I mean, it's just disgusting. Like, instead of arguing with facts, they're trying to like intimidate, they're trying to like suppress people from speaking up. It's amazing to me that kind of thing is happening on Stanford campus. And there was a group of people who, faculty members, you know, some of whom I've known and previously respected, who put together a petition asking the president of the university, in effect, to censor me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because of, you know, you've said things about masks, and all you've said is that there's not sufficient evidence here.
Yeah. Like in child masks, there's not a single randomized trial. That's all I said, which is absolutely 100% true. We have a population-wide intervention on children that is potentially harmful to them, but we have no randomized evidence evaluating them at all 19 months into the epidemic. You know, we're the only country, I think, that masks two-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah, so everybody got upset about American Airlines forcing somebody to mask a two-year-old child, but, I mean, that was a dumb move, but I think they're aiming their ire in the wrong place. I think that is a requirement on the...
Yeah, the CDC is telling to mask two-year-olds. The American Airlines, all they're doing is enforcing what the Biden administration said, which is you have to, it's a federal law that two-year-olds be masked on planes.
Right. So they should be saying, Joe Biden, stop doing this. But instead, they're all talking about American Airlines. It's like they can't keep their eye on the ball or something.
Masking two-year-olds. I mean, that's just, you're talking about how irrational. I mean, I have some friends who have very young kids and they send their kids to preschool. They tell me is that at preschool, when they're napping, the kids take the mask off. Thank God, right? But when they're not napping, they have to put the mask on. It's like the COVID doesn't come out of them, I guess, when they're sleeping.
Right, right. So it goes to show that it makes no sense, or the people doing this don't really believe it, or who knows what's going on. Let me encourage people. I'm going to put at tomwoods.com/1974, our show notes page, a link to Dr. Bhattacharya's Twitter. He made the poorest decision of his professional life. He joined Twitter recently. but you joined last month, and you're already over 42,000 followers. That is, you know, for somebody who isn't a rock star, you know, you're a medical rock star. I mean, that's a really great achievement, and I'm thrilled to be following you there. So I want people to follow you there. It's kind of hard. It's DR, and then your initial J, and then Bhattacharya. Just go to tomwoods.com/1974, click on there, and follow him, because you'll get a nice dose of sanity pretty regularly. And also, it would... Poor Dr. Bhattacharya joining Twitter at its most contentious moment ever. Just remind him that there is a good side to human nature, you know, namely the folks listening to this program. So, Jay, I appreciate your time and everything you've been doing. Honestly, I think you're just a wonderful human being all around. We're so lucky to have you, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, for talking with me. Really appreciate it.
All right, everybody, before we go, just a reminder that the long-awaited debate between Scott Horton and Bill Kristol about foreign interventionism is taking place October 4th, and you can watch it on a live stream or in person in New York City. And for details about that, you can check out thesohoforum.org. It's October 4th once again. And as I say, there's a live stream available. Both ways are available to you. And I just wanted, for the sake of our friend Gene Epstein, who has worked so hard on the Soho Forum and has done such heroic work, just to let you all know about that, thesohoforum.org. And we all wish Scott Horton every good wish and all the good luck in the world. I'm sure he is going to smash this debate to smithereens, and we're all rooting for him. So thesohoforum.org is where to go for information about that, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.